When I'm driving a car, I feel like I'm watching a movie. And when I'm riding my bike, I feel like I'm in the movie. And it's like, just like you're part of it, you know, and it's not all just nature. It's like when I ride by the taco trucks in LA, I smell the taco trucks. I hear all the languages that people are talking as they're walking around. I like smell the fresh cut grass as guys are working on people's lawns. It's you know, it's not like I'm in this living room listening to a podcast, no offense to podcasts. It's just like I'm out there experiencing the world I live in. And it's really easy to get disconnected from that. Like the bicycle is an incredible way to make you feel more connected to where you are.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Active Towns channel. My name is John Zimmerman, and that is Peter Flax, the author of the new book, Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle. We're going to go into this new book, which, by the way, is a beautiful new book that I really think everyone should have. So, you know what? Let's get right to it with Peter so you can see why. Peter Flax, thank you so much for joining me on the Active Towns podcast. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Peter, I love to give my guests just an opportunity to do a really quick introduction. So who the heck is Peter Flax?
Peter Flax is a writer and editor who lives in Los Angeles now. I've been here for about 10 years, and I've been writing and editing about a lot of topics, but especially bikes, for almost 30 years now. So I have been an editor for more than 30 years and writing about bikes since the 90s.
I love it. I love it. And I mentioned to you when I reached out to you about doing this episode that I kind of have this love-hate relationship with Los Angeles. I'm a fourth generation Los Angelino. Spent many, many years living there. And every time when I'm gone, I miss it. And then when I'm there, I can't wait to leave. How's your decade been treating you there?
Well, it's been great, I guess. I guess probably how anybody would react when they reflect on living somewhere for a decade. As a place to ride, it's thrilling and almost always sunny and often dramatic. You know, it's not a low-key place to ride, but I'm able to ride year-round. I don't own a car, and I do something like almost 8,000 miles a year just commuting back and forth to my office. So life is good for me in that way. And, you know, so much of what my new book comes from is just how I had to reorient my riding life after moving to LA. And so I now feel kind of warm and fuzzy about the whole thing because I like it steered my riding life in a way that I didn't expect.
Yeah. And that's a good point, too, because your history, of course, is that you were in the industry, in the bicycle industry, writing about the bicycle industry for many, many years. And then that move a decade ago, basically in 2014, sort of marked a transition for you. Not only were you changing coasts, you went from the East Coast to the West Coast, but you were also getting, you know, moving away from, you know, writing about, you know, professionally writing about bicycling necessarily every day as part of your job.
Yeah. When I moved to LA, I took a job with the Hollywood Reporter. And for the first time in a long time, I wasn't getting paid to cover anything bike related. And so I had to find my way of what my purpose or role in bike culture would be. So it has been a really interesting experience to stumble into this, where before I was someone who was editor of the biggest bike magazine in the U.S. So totally different.
Yeah. And you and I, this is the first time we've had a chance to be face to face with each other, you know, over the interwebs, over a video phone call here. But this is how I know Peter Flax is PFlax1 out on Twitter. Very, very prolific tweeter out there and have a very, very strong following. This is how I've known you for years. How long have you been really active out there on Twitter, you know, kind of putting content out, talking about bicycling and all things safer streets and obviously Los Angeles over the last decade.
Oh, I think I've been on Twitter for almost 15 years. At some point a long time ago, the CEO of the company I worked for like forced me to get on and live tweet during like a Al Gore debate or something, like really weird. But I got like really into it maybe like 12 years ago, I guess, 13 years ago. And I think found my way and my voice, leaving bicycling and not being affiliated with a bike brand has certainly like freed me up to just be more honest about what I feel. I definitely, probably to a fault or beyond that, just say what's on my mind. And so I have a lot of people that love to follow me and a lot of people who hate to follow me or hate me. And that's just something I'm okay with. It is a freeing thing to have a platform where you can just say what you think.
It's really interesting too, and you can kind of comment on this, is that platform and the interactions of, you know, quote unquote, hashtag bike Twitter and the audience that is out there. Obviously, we don't have to get too far into the fact that it's changed a little bit in the last couple of years, but it was really a special place in the sense that there was a lot of stuff going on. Yeah, sometimes you get a little bit of vitriol here and there and you kind of get some trolls occasionally, but there's also an awful lot of camaraderie out there, an awful lot of love out there, and as well as just being able to make connections, even like this connection right here.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm honest, I think that it really has gone to crap in the last couple of years. And, you know, at its peak, which lasted a long time, it was like this incredible community where I constantly was meeting people who expanded my perspectives and who I would commune with over various things I love about bikes. And I made a ton of real friends. And now I'd say at least half the people that I really care about have just bailed on the platform. And just like in so many vertical spaces on Twitter, it's just gotten uglier, but I still find it useful. It's still like better to me than my alternatives now. And it's, you know, a great town square for people who love bikes. And the part of what, again, my book touches on is that like bike culture is so far from monolithic that there are so many different sides to the community. And that Twitter was this place where everyone communed together. And that part of what I've seen in the last 10 years of like things like pro bike racers getting involved in advocacy, a lot of that like happened through conversation on Twitter. Like as a platform, the way that people exchanged ideas and the polemic conversations that happened like have really shaped the culture in the last 10 years.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% on each of those points. And I did pull up, the very first tweet or post that I see here, from 4 hours ago. Again, what a lovely book, Peter Flax. Thank you for your work on behalf of the entire community of cyclists. And I think that's kind of the whole point, is this really is, you know, it's a little bit of a love letter to riding a bike. And there's like no judgment. And I think that's part of what is there. And I'll let you expand upon that, is that, you know, if you're riding, if you're getting out there, you're doing it right. There's no judgment here.
Yeah. I've this is an idea that has come to me like slowly and relentlessly over the time since I moved to LA, of when I moved here, realizing that this old idea I had that everyone was in one or two subcultures that defined what kind of rider you were. And then I got here and suddenly felt like I'm not really in any of them. Like I have one foot in a bunch of them and I just don't know who I am as a rider. And then slowly realizing that these things that we love about riding are this glue that doesn't get talked about enough. And like very, gratified that you call it a love letter. It's not a term I would use, but I think it that's what it is. Like it started with me. Like I originally wanted to call this book Why We Ride. But it turns out someone wrote a motorcycle book of that name, so it was off the table. But it was an exploration of why I and other people ride, independent of what kind of apparel or bicycle they sit on. And it took a year of thinking and then 2 years of writing to distill down that thinking into what you just held up. And so to have it finally be out in the world and people like tweeting at me that they loved it is really moving, because it was a labor of love.
Yeah. And what's really, really special about this is you take the readers on a journey and a little bit, you know, starting with yourself and sort of how you started out with the bicycle, but you take the reader on a journey, and on this journey, you introduce us to several many different characters. And that's what you kind of mentioned there, is that there's these like little profiles of these interesting and influential people. And, you know, really culminating with what we just talked about is, you know, it really isn't necessarily about our tribes that we may have within this, but it really is this concept: if you ride, you're doing it right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the people that are in the book are really important to me, that, you know, I mean, I'm honest, I'm a lifelong magazine editor. So when I set out to write a book, it kind of is like, in some ways, a book length magazine article, where just the way I package in elements. But I think you can't really capture the just beautiful diversity within this space if you don't talk to the people that capture the very best of the space. And so, with the exception of Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo, who I still don't know, I know everybody else well who I interview and profile, and having them all together in one place is really meaningful to me, and hopefully to other people.
Yeah. And I pulled up, you know, sort of the table of contents, the introductions of contents here, so that you can see that we have it basically divided up into these six different chapters or subcategories. Why don't you talk a little bit about how you went about doing that, and how you decided to, you know, sort of choose these six as the big buckets?
Yeah. It's as a trivia question, it was originally seven, and I had self-expression and beauty as two separate ideas, and I wound up combining them. But these are like, when after spending like a year thinking about it, were these like connective threads that are the things that people love about riding, and that, like, whether you're a casual transit rider or a hardcore commuter or a mountain biker or a road racer, a triathlete, that these are all things that I think you treasure about your riding life. And so each chapter then goes into that idea, where I substantiate what the idea is about and how it can manifest itself in different ways, and go through some history that's relevant in that area, and equipment that's sort of the best, you know, best case of what equipment can look like in that space, like a dream ride, really, like, hopefully in total, people who come into it and think like, oh, like, I don't think adventure is part of my riding life. And I think most people do, but if they didn't, I think when they read it, they'll be like, oh, I actually do. Like, I love being on a bike, and the way it captures this feeling of being a child again, of discovering things and hearing and seeing things that I wasn't expecting. And the same with the other chapters.
As I'm looking at these six different areas here, I identify with all six of those in many different ways across my embarrassing number of bikes that happen to be in the garage.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I think some people are least sure about competition. Like, the amount of people who race bikes in the U.S. is a relatively small number. And so it's like easiest to dismiss that as something that you're like, well, I don't race. But then a lot of people are like, oh, I love using Strava, or I love testing myself in some way, that the sense of like how you find things out about yourself by testing yourself is pretty universal. Bike is like an incredible thing for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I could easily see, I see what you mean by the competition. I could also see a competition slash sport slash recreation, but you could even say that about, you know, that being captured in some of these other categories as well, as such as speed and et cetera, and even nature. I mean, it's just, for me, it was an absolute joy to go through this book. And I have to ask though, too, I think I know the answer, but what really inspired you to do it as a book?
I just felt like it was too big. And I've written a lot of relatively big magazine stories. Like I've written a bunch of, you know, 10,000 word magazine stories, which is about as big as those get. And this was just too big an idea for that. And that I felt, once I started thinking about, there are relatively few books for bike riders that like aspire to capture something broad about the culture. And that kind of freaked me out, which is good for me. Like that I was like, I didn't, it's not like I could go to the bookstore and pick out a book and be like, oh, this is sort of, I want to update this for like the 2020s. It wasn't like that at all. And so I guess I decided that I was going to like try and capture a broad perspective of why people ride.
Yeah. And I guess I asked that question the way that I did, you know, fully knowing that as a journalist, you've been in the heart of doing that for many, many years. And as an editor, you've been a part of those stories. But I guess the context of that too, is that the result, the end result of this is that it's beautiful. And the reason why I say it in that way is because sometimes when we think of book, you're like, oh yeah, I mean, this is like, oh, it's completely, I mean, I've got one sitting right over there that I'm going to be releasing tomorrow on the podcast, that there's not a single photo in the entire, you know, tome. It's rich and in its description and its verbiage really brings the story to life. But in your case, I mean, we've got beautiful photography in here and it's a very, very high quality book and the paper is very, very high quality. So it's so rich to be able to, like, you know, enjoy the story and the images that come about. Was that something that was going to be very important for you to make sure that this was something that almost you would expect to see somebody have on a coffee table?
Yeah, that was kind of the idea from the start, for it to be like a miniature coffee table kind of book. And yeah, maybe because I've been an editor at a magazine for so long that I think I appreciate what strong photography can do. And I know that like the experience of writing for me is so visceral that I think that words and photos together can connect with people in a way that words alone can't. And the principal photography in the book is from Jared and Ashley Gruber and John Watson, who are all people I've known and worked with and been friends with for a pretty long time. And they have kind of different focal points with the kind of writing photography they do. And so I felt like with them, I could get really beautiful photography that like covered, say, 90% of what I wanted in the book. And I think that when I talk to people now who've seen the book, I think they understand the power of this photography, because it's like, if it is like a love letter, this just makes it more emotional, right? When you look at a photo like what I see on the screen right now, it's like people having fun, they're in a beautiful place, they're looks like they're on their bike at either the beginning or the end of the day as the sun is breaking over trees. And there's just something so joyful and profound about the imagery that like underscores why we love this so much. Like it's like for me, and I think a lot of people, riding is not, this is not a hobby. This is like a way of life for me. And so I want that emotional quality to come through in the imagery.
Yeah. And you use the joy word, which of course is, you know, part of the title, in that it's live to ride, finding joy and meaning on a bicycle.
Yeah. And, I think that part of this also came from my experience in the last few years on Twitter, where, you know, I love a good debate or even an argument, and things can get like so polemic and so ideological that I really wanted to do something just purely positive, to really to really spend time kind of bathing in the things that I love about riding and the things that unify everyone. And that was a really positive experience for me, that while I, you know, their advocacy, I think, is like in this book in quiet ways, but it's not, this is not a book trying to like tell people why we need more bike lanes or why drivers are idiots, which I can do plenty of on Twitter. This is about why we ride. And like, right, so if you see a beautiful shot of someone riding in Copenhagen, there's, I think, a lot of stealth advocacy in that kind of, it's like visual propaganda of, well, this is the dream. This is why we ride. Nobody's going to like have a photo of someone riding in a crappy shoulder in Los Angeles with people in Escalades going 60 miles an hour next to them. So there is advocacy in here, but it's like framed in a really positive, you know, inspirational way.
Yeah. And the image that we have on screen right now is, of course, of the snake there in Copenhagen, which is just an absolutely gorgeous cycling bridge that, connects, it goes over the water, connects some critical areas there in the city of Copenhagen. And I think it really is important to understand that the whole reason why we're pushing so hard to try to create, transform our built environment into areas that are really safe and inviting and welcoming to everyone to ride is so that more people can, in fact, experience that joy and freedom and utility and all of these other things that you capture in the book.
Yeah, I totally agree, obviously. And one point I try and make a number of times in the book is that if everybody who rides realizes how much they have in common with everyone else who rides, even if their riding life is different, that we have so much more strength as a community, and that it's not like, right? Like, I know I've been a part of the advocacy community for a relatively long time, and it's easy to feel like you're in this battle by yourself in the advocacy community. But the reality is that now roadies are riding to the coffee shop and have other kinds of bikes that they're riding in. And everybody is sharing this experience that the roads and their communities aren't as good as they could be for riding. And so the more that everybody like realizes that we're all just brothers and sisters riding, the more power we have to change things for the better.
Yeah. And I love the power in the imagery that comes out of Copenhagen, because the Danes, especially there in Copenhagen, they don't even consider themselves cyclists. They just, this is just what we do. They don't even consider it a culture. It's just a pragmatic way of getting around. And it's I think a great illustration and lesson for us all when we're looking at trying to advocate for safer, more welcoming places within our communities that accepts all different types of riders, is to also understanding that we can sometimes like go overboard in our in our enthusiasm of our tribes and of our groups. And I think you do a beautiful job of talking about that, paying homage to the fact that yes, we as human nature, we do naturally sort of get over there. But just like, as I mentioned, I can see myself in all six of those different buckets, because I have, yes, I have my racing bike. Yes, I have my mountain bike. Yes, I have my commuter bike. And yes, I have my travel bike, and on and on and on and on and on. I see myself in all of those different layers, a typical comment from someone in the Netherlands or someone in Denmark might be, well, I don't call myself a cyclist any more than I would call myself a vacuumist if I'm vacuuming my, you know, my living room.
Yeah, I think a lot of Americans are increasingly tuned in to that. And I often try to avoid the word cyclist because it's easy to be misunderstood. Like in some ways, I think a cyclist can just be a person who rides a bike, but the term carries some historical baggage at this point in the U.S. And I do think, you know, as you mentioned at the outset, my philosophy now is like, if you're riding a bike, you're doing it right. And so you don't have to imagine yourself as like an enthusiast, right? It like has all these sporting connotations. And I feel like I am a cyclist and I am a bike rider. And those are two circles that intersect, but aren't exactly the same thing.
Yeah. And zooming in on a photo of, this is not in your book, this is of my good friends, the Bruntlets, on vacation, actually. In this particular photo, they are actually on their family vacation in Copenhagen, of all places, although they now live in Delft in the Netherlands. When I first met Chris and Melissa, when they were still living in the Vancouver area, the very first thing that they said to me was, why do you want to interview us? You know, we're not active. We're not sports people. And I'm like, oh, I'm like, no. I definitely want to interview you. You're precisely the story that I want to talk about. And that is activity, physical activity doesn't have to automatically be assumed that you're athletic or it's a sport related type of activity.
Yeah. They're like a great inspiration to me. And I don't know if I could think of anybody in bike culture that's been more relentlessly constructive than them, that you never will see them get in an argument with anyone. And there's no hot takes from them. It's really like, I have a couple of cookbooks in my kitchen where I know that if I pull them out, that I'm going to get this really dependably great recipe of how to make something that I'm going to want. And I feel like that's what their content is like a cookbook of full of dependable recipes to make things better. And they really have impacted bike culture on multiple continents by doing that.
Yeah. And they are authors of two fabulous books themselves. And we'll be sure to leave those links in the show notes below. The reason why I'm actually zooming in is not to diss Henrique, who is their tour guide, but I'm actually focusing in on the person who is behind them, sort of doing a little photobomb there, because she's on a mobility trike. And that really sort of emphasizes what I try to reinforce. When we talk about cycling infrastructure, we're not talking about this being something that is for, again, the cyclists, the people who stereotypically we think of. We're really talking about safe and inviting all ages and all abilities. And we see somebody getting around on an ability tricycle there.
Yeah, if I'm honest, that I used to like ride and see people on like recumbents or trikes and just kind of be struck by their otherness. And now I feel something so radically different that like when like I ride on the beach path on the way to work in LA, and there's a lot of people who are on recumbents and trikes. And I just feel like, man, we're just in this together on a slightly different machine. And the reasons why we're out here are the same damn reasons. And so I'm like a little embarrassed to think that I used to make jokes about dudes on recumbents, like, you know, and just like I made jokes about triathletes or a certain kind of mountain biker. And it was always good natured. But that like I leaned into that segmentation, and now I just feel like a real genuine sort of love for everyone who rides. Like it's still like this big group of weirdos who love to do this thing. And I just feel like, yeah, we're all family.
Yeah. If we really are successful, then we're not going to be a big group of weirdos. We'll, it will get to the point, just like they have in the Netherlands, as well as in a large part of Denmark and many other places. It's just, yeah, it's just another mobility mode. It's not an otherness. It's just like, yeah, oh yeah. It's a practical way to get around. And sometimes it's a great way to recreate and experience nature and dot, 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 all these other aspects of it.
Yeah, it's almost otherworldly when you make it sound that simple, right? Like I totally agree with you. And I often just get frustrated why it's not happening faster in North America, because it just feels like in my lifetime, I presume that everything will get better in a continual way. But I sort of imagine that when I'm done riding, I'll still feel like a weirdo just because of how much resistance there is to just accepting all these joys and meanings of bike culture. Like, we're going to get more mainstream and riding will be safer and more popular. But I still think 20 years from now that we'll still feel like weirdos. That's just my guess. Love to be wrong.
Hopefully you're wrong on that. Hopefully we won't still be considered weirdos on that. What's really, really interesting about too, where you happen to live, and before we hit the record button, you know, I divulged that, you know, I used to hang out there all the time in the South Bay area. I learned how to surf while I was attending USC for undergrad right there at 30th Street in Hermosa Beach, and then spent a lot of time surfing all up and down the area there, especially El Porto, which you had mentioned that you ride right past on your way to the office. What's really great about a path like that, which has been a vibrant path, well, ever since I was there in the early 80s, is that you do see all types. And you mentioned it, you know, with the mobility trikes and other recumbents and things like that. That's the point, is that when you do have a safe and inviting infrastructure and a network of that infrastructure, is you have a broader diversity of the overall population, you know, that's doing that. And the process of building out our network is, you know, it's money at some point, it's political will, certainly. But when we look to the experience there in the Netherlands that, you know, the Brentwoods have so eloquently discussed in their books, it's not out of reach. I mean, they essentially transformed their built environment over basically a 5-decade period. The majority of their infrastructure has actually been built. I think it's some 70 to 80% of the network has been built since the 1990s. So there's
I definitely think the transformation is possible here and will happen here. I think it's all a question of just how long it's going to take and how many people will be scared off from riding in the meantime. And so I feel attuned to it. I think it's to be in a place like Los Angeles, it's impossible not to be attuned to it, right? Like, I ride my bicycle to work and it's almost always beautiful weather. And the car trip from where I live to where I work is horrible. Like, everyone walks into the office just like hating life and then wondering when they're going to get some time to like work out or think, you know, without being assaulted by the world. And I get all of those things. And there are a lot of like institutional challenges that will need to be overcome, but I totally think they will happen. I think just there's all these forces that are happening that will make it happen, because the bike is the answer to so many questions. And so I just feel like it'll happen. But I think if you ride a lot in a city in the US, it's easy to get frustrated at the pace it's happening. Right. I get that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally. Totally. And as somebody who has basically 5 decades, close to 5 decades worth of experience, also riding in Southern California, I can say that in when I visit Southern California, I usually travel with my traveling bicycle. So I've got my Brompton with me. I'll fly into LAX. I'll take the little shuttle bus over so that I can get on whatever the train is, the green train or whatever, and then make my way into the downtown LA area. I usually get off the train there near the USC campus so I can ride on my bike through campus and remember the glory days of being there in the 80s. But then I'll ride my bike from USC campus into the downtown LA area, taking in the protected bike lane along Figueroa. I was actually there documenting it right after they opened it, and NACTO was there, had their annual meeting there. Jump on the train again, go through Pasadena, head out to where my relatives are out in the Glendora area. And I'm really noticing that that's one of the great things that a lot of people don't know about the LA metro area, is that it is the fastest mover in terms of the total number of miles of rail transit that's being built out and really helping to facilitate. And this is really the thing that I love the most about the Dutch network, is that you have an overlay of being able to get on a train, do that longer trip, then you get off the train, and then you've got an integrated cycle network. And so the fact that they're building out the metro line, and hopefully they will catch up and build a little bit more quickly, as you were talking about, alluding to that bicycle network that is considered an all ages and abilities type of bicycle network, as well as taking advantage of the quiet residential streets, which is oftentimes the hidden beauty of the Dutch system and the Danish system, is that the 60 to 70% of their cycle network is actually some form of shared space where there's low traffic and low speed environment.
Right.
I think LA's got, because you mentioned it's got the great weather. So the potential is
Super high. I like in the last year, I've got this new hobby of trying to concoct long bike rides that involve a train. And so I've looked at Metrolink as sort of the longer distance commuter rail system. And I just look at what the end of each of the lines are and whether I can just like ride a bike there and then take a train home. So I've like ridden to San Bernardino and ridden down to Oceanside and, you know, going places where, rather than trying to do a round trip where I loop back to where I started, I just end at a train station and can like buy a bunch of stuff at 7-Eleven and sit on a train and recuperate and enjoy the ride.
Yeah. And, you know, and I was just up in Santa Barbara documenting the build out of their bicycle network, because they're really moving fast to try to do a better job there. And I was interviewing some of the city staff there, and we were talking about the fact that, yeah, you can like catch the train, come on up from LA, get off of the train. And their dream is to be able to have safe and inviting infrastructure that, you know, can get people around and you can explore the entire city.
Yeah, it's a great city to ride in. I think a lot of university towns are kind of ahead of like other towns. You know, I think a lot of ways, just like anywhere where there's a lot of young people who are like just more open to things being different and better, there's like less of this, you know, sort of baby boomer status quo oriented people who, you know, have a harder time thinking about the positives of change.
Yeah. Is there anything that we haven't mentioned yet about the book, the narrative, storylines that you want to make sure to leave the audience with?
Well, I guess we didn't talk much about nature. And I would say that, like, even for people who live in cities, this is a really important element of riding, that I think our lives have just become so busy and so digitized. That feeling of like, whether for me it's riding along the ocean or someone who goes to a city park to just do a few laps, you know, we're really needing connection to the outdoors. We're needing to feel like alive and aware of the weather and the terrain and the wind. And I think there's something really primal and important in like experiencing the natural world on a bike, that I totally get why people go to a gym and do a spin class, or they ride in the winter and do Zwift. And so I just, the efficiency of that is great. But I think being outside And riding is such a beautiful thing that most people who ride really appreciate. That even like, right, like our apparel choices, you can be comfortable in a really wide range of weather and environments. There's something about it that makes you feel alive. And I'm just like aware of that all the time, of how I feel sustained in my riding by being in the natural world.
I'm really glad that you brought that up and mentioned that. It harkens back to some conversations that I've had with Ryan Van Duzer, who has a wonderful channel out here on YouTube. And he talks about that a lot. He does these adventure videos and really talks about how that, getting that connectivity and connection to nature. And he always tries to capture a little bit of that beauty, from his adventures. So it's not adrenaline, this and all that. It's like taking that deep breath, taking the time to appreciate it. And sometimes that glimpse of nature can be a part of just your daily routine too. I can remember beautiful mornings there in Manhattan Beach, especially in the wintertime after a big storm or something, and the wind would whip through across the sand and create like this corduroy effect on the sand. And even before a very first, footstep ever even touched it. And it's one of the things that we have a chance to appreciate when we're moving, closer to human speed, when we're moving at 10 miles an hour on the bike path. And we're like, oh, wow, this is just extraordinarily beautiful and powerful.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I my wife has a car and I have some responsibilities that involve me driving. And the way I think about it is that when I'm driving a car, I feel like I'm watching a movie. And when I'm riding my bike, I feel like I'm in the movie. And it's like just you're part of it, and it's not all just nature. It's like, when I ride by the taco trucks in LA, I smell the taco trucks. I hear all the languages that people are talking as they're walking around. I like smell the fresh cut grass as guys are working on people's lawns. It's it's not like I'm in this living room listening to a podcast, no offense to podcasts. It's just like I'm out there experiencing the world I live in. And it's really easy to get disconnected from that. Like the bicycle is an incredible way to make you feel more connected to where you are.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's powerful to have that opportunity to have that presence and be able to be right there in the moment. And you mentioned the headphones, and listening to things. I tend to listen to my podcast when I'm just sort of walking in my neighborhood around here. But when I try to have my run in the trail, I always make sure that I'm not wearing headphones. I want to be in the moment. I want to be present. I want to hear the birds, because that's part of, activating all of our senses. I get the sense that you do that when you ride too. You're not listening to things.
Yeah, it's almost hard for me to explain. Like, I spend a lot of time on my bike and I never listen to content or music. I just, I think it would be like if someone was really into, say, yoga, they wouldn't listen to music or a podcast when they do it. It's like there's something more than just a physical activity happening. And so I want to be present in a certain sort of way, and I want to be like lost mentally in a certain sort of way. Like a lot of times I'm just mulling over things in my life and things with work. And when I get to work and I take a shower and suddenly like three ideas are in my head, and that's because of the way I'm open to it and the flow state I'm in from riding. And so I wouldn't want to be listening. There's nothing boring about it to me. And also like riding in LA, I think I just want to be 100% tuned in to what's going on around me. It's not at all a ride in the park. The one other thing I'll say that we didn't talk about was self-expression, which was the hardest chapter to write, because it's really about a few different things. Like part of it superficially is just about this way in which fashion has seeped into riding culture, where you can wear whatever you want. And there's just like more ways to just be your true self when you're on a bike, but on a deeper level, it becomes this sense of about tolerance and equity and about being open to not just your own ability to express yourself on your bike, but to just accept everybody else who's different than you expressing themselves on a bike. And I've seen in the last 4 or 5 years, a lot of positive change and a lot of friction around that latter topic. And so wanted to like do some thinking about that, right? That all manner of people who have like different life circumstances and have different choices and a different lifestyle, a different life are riding, and that to just lean as far away from those differences as possible, to really think that everybody's just trying to find their way and the bike is this tool to help them feel whole. And so I do think that's about as ideological and polemic as the book gets. And even then, I think it's hopefully a soft touch, but it's like this idea of acceptance that bike advocacy is part of this larger advocacy movement of just wanting everyone to feel safe in their lives, whether they're on a bike or off a bike. And so if you're talking about bike advocacy, you have to think about what life is like off the bike for a lot of people. And so the chapter gets into some of that, of how these beautiful challenges that our culture are wrestling with, how they play out in bike culture.
Yeah. And of course, the image that we have on screen right now is an expression of that a little bit, in the sense that, you know, this is the bike life sort of movement and the joy, especially in the inner cities, of, you know, people expressing themselves. You can kind of look and see that they have customized their bikes. They love their bikes. They get together. They have a hoot. They have a great deal of fun while doing it. But as you mentioned too, you know, the expression chapter really goes into a diversity of different themes and really embraces, you know, again, that cross section of the diversity that exists out on our streets and in our cities as it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's understood, almost unspoken, that everyone who rides thinks doing wheelies is cool. And I cannot personally do a dependable wheelie. And so I feel great admiration and envy for those kids. And, you know, to live in an urban area where you don't have the easiest access to the kind of riding that a lot of other people take for granted, and to like carve out this really artistic culture that has this political element to it, I think it's I think bike life is a beautiful thing. And I'm like, just so happy that I consider those men and women like my brothers and sisters. Like, I think it's so cool. And I think there's a lot of like elements of bike culture that are like that, that I just want to bring in and not think of as other.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that I love too is like when there's a mashup of different identities and different cultures. And I noticed this when I lived in Southern California, and I also noticed it when I lived in Hawaii. Is that, you know, I would be like, oh yeah, I love to ride. And oh yeah, I love to ride both my surfboard and my bike. And I loved that utility of being able to throw the board on the bike and be able to check out the different surf breaks and see what's happening and connect with, you know, friends and other people that, you know, are actual friends, but other people who you recognize and they're sort of like, oh yeah, the recognized stranger that you don't really know their name, but you always say hi. There's a certain level of social cohesion that comes from that and being able to travel closer at human speed.
Yeah. The whole culture of surfing and riding together is such a beautiful thing. I think in a place like Manhattan Beach, or maybe even more at a place like San Clemente, that you realize at some point the utility of a bike is like off the charts, right? Like that in Manhattan Beach, where I live, there's one popular break that's got a giant parking lot. And so it's always really crowded. But there are spots that are like a mile or two away that are just as good. And if you have a bike that can take a surfboard, you suddenly can access things that are challenging with a car, and right, like this way in which, like, so I get in all these polemic arguments on Twitter where people are like, well, let's see you, you know, go to Home Depot and buy like, you know, 100 cinder blocks and get those home on your bike. And it's like, okay, but there are tons of things where the bike is the optimal way to do something with utility, right? Like I live like 3/4 of a mile from a Trader Joe's that always has like a million people circling the parking lot looking for a space and hating themselves. And I'm like a VIP where I roll up to the front door and park my bike and walk in. And it's undoubtedly the fastest, least stressful way to shop at Trader Joe's. And there's thousands of examples of things like that where the bike is triumphal.
Yeah.
Carry a huge plant, for instance, right?
There you go.
Turn is so sweet. I love that bike.
I love that bike too. Yeah, that is my bike. that's the Turn GSD with the Gates belt drive on there. And it's a workhorse. And yeah, talking about, you know, going rolling to the grocery store, and yeah, I can easily, you know, pick up $250 worth of groceries and get it up the steep hill up to the house here in South Austin. And yeah, and I'm really glad that the conversation went in this direction, because it talks a little bit about the power of electric assist and what it can do for us. Because honestly, with North America, with the distances that we have in front of us, it does put us at a little bit more of a disadvantage when we do, you know, city by city comparisons to a place like Delft in the Netherlands, where Chris and Melissa and the family live. And so having that little bit of electric assist really helps flatten those hills, decrease the amount of strain that steep wind in your face can do. Talk a little bit about that perspective, because I suspect that you probably have had a little bit of a shift in your own view of what electric and e-assist bikes have been, you know, over the period. I know I have.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I first tried e-bikes when I was working at Bicycling. So these were 12, 13 years ago. And at the time, they seemed like fun toys, right? And I always thought they were cool, but they seemed like recreational toys. And I didn't see the full utility. And so, yeah, my perspective has changed. I have a Benno cargo bike, and I use it a little bit less than I did a few years ago, because I'm just in a mode of feeling fit and just liking to do everything on a conventional bike. But there have been times where it was really important vehicle in my life. And I do think this old trope that a lot of road cyclists have, that e-bikes are cheating somehow, is like got to be one of the dumber tropes in bike culture, right? Like you're being... like we're in a culture where people like get in a 6,000-pound SUV and like drive to Starbucks and get drive through and then drive home, right? Like being on a pedal assist bike is not cheating in any way. And that for all the emotional things I talk about in the book of like the reasons why you ride, they all apply. Like it's everyone who rides an e-bike knows they're on a bike, right? Like the physics and the emotions are the same, and that it gives like a wider range of people a sense of what our infrastructure is like and how and what driving culture is like. It's all positives as far as I'm concerned, and feel like usually when I hear people complaining about e-bikes, they've never ridden one.
Yeah, absolutely. Peter, this has been so much fun. I'm gonna pull up the book here. This is my bookshop. This is the Active Towns bookshop, and I've got your book right here on the podcast, featured books right next to Chris and Melissa's two books, Curbing Traffic and Building the Cycling City. And folks, pick up this book. This is a fantastic book. The publisher, Hachette Book Group. Again, Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle. Peter Flax, this has been such a joy having you on the Active Towns podcast. Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed the conversation. We kind of went over just such a wide range of topics. It's been a great conversation.
Hey, thank you all so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, please, hey, give it a thumbs up, leave a comment down below, and share it with a friend. And if you haven't done so already, I'd be honored to have you subscribe to the channel. Just click on that subscription button down below. And if you're enjoying this content here on the Active Towns channel, please consider supporting my efforts. It's easy to do. Become an Active Towns ambassador. Just click on the link down below at activetowns.org. Then click on the support button. There's several different options, including becoming a Patreon supporter. All patrons do get early and ad-free access to all my videos. And hey, thank you all so much for tuning in today. I really do appreciate it. And until next time, this is John signing off by wishing you much activity, health, and happiness. Cheers. And again, sending a huge thank you out to all my Active Towns ambassadors supporting the channel on Patreon, Buy Me a Coffee, YouTube Super Thanks, as well as making contributions to the nonprofit and purchasing things from the Active Towns store. Every little bit adds up and it's much appreciated. Thank you all so much.